I'm actually sort of a last-minute fill-in to give this talk, and it's a little strange because normally, actually, I never prepare a talk. Well, I prepare, but I never write a talk. Only I wrote a talk, even though I'm a last-minute fill-in. Usually, I use slides or something like that. But I'm actually probably not going to stick to the script anyway. I'm reminded Marvin Minsky, another longtime colleague at MIT, was giving a keynote at AAAI one time, and he walked up to the podium with a bunch of papers with a talk. And again, Marvin's not one to stick to the script by any means, but he puts his papers down on the podium, and he looks down, and he looks up at the audience, and he says, "Yeah, this is a list of things that my wife told me not to talk about." And then he drifts away from the podium, as Marvin is wont to do, and then comes back maybe about a half an hour, 45 minutes later, he's back to the podium, he looks down at the list, looks back at the audience, and he says, "Yeah, covered all those." So I'm going to sort of cover a lot of topics. I'll probably will say some things I regret later, but that's okay. Few people, as they were introducing themselves, used an acronym OLPC. OLPC stands for One Laptop Per Child, and it's a project that I have been involved in. I had been involved in for about 30 months up until recently. And it and a number of other efforts were taken to really transform education around the world. And the core thesis was that by providing the best tool we know of for learning, which is a connected computer, we would have a positive impact on learning around the world, and also have an impact on all the things that learning impacts. So learning, one could argue there are lots of problems in the world, food, water, war, disease. It's hard to argue that laptops are the solution to these problems, but it's not hard to argue that learning is part of the solution to all these problems. And so one of the things that to keep in mind as I'm going through my talk is I'm going to talk about laptops, and I'm going to talk about software and programming and things like that, but it's really all in service to the learning. It's all, what do we have to do to impact learning? And the problem that we saw 30 years ago, that we saw 30 months ago, and that we still see today is that there are a lot of children out there who don't have opportunity. They're not lacking in capability, but they're lacking in opportunity for learning. And so the question is, how do you reach those children? How do you give them high-quality education? Because it really is essential to build an equitable society, to give every child that opportunity to learn. Again, I'm of a belief, and you know, there's a book that came out a few months ago by a colleague of mine, Dan Ariely. It's called Predictably Irrational. Chapter 2 is about anchoring and how we anchor ourselves to ideas, and then that colors everything else that that we do. And I've been anchored to the idea that technology has a role in learning from hanging out at MIT for 30 plus years and hanging out with people like Seymour Papert. So I'm anchored to the idea, again, that a connected computer is the most powerful tool we know of today for knowledge creation and knowledge appropriation. I'd love to hear about other tools that are more powerful than that, but that's the one I'm anchored to. And then finally, there's a question of scale. Because at MIT, working with Seymour, and Seymour long before I got involved, we've been doing one pilot project after another after another. Seymour started this business in the early 1960s, and it works. But the question is, how do you make it work to scale? It's really a matter of the challenge is not can you learn? The challenge is, how do you take that model of learning then and make it reach every child, or give every child an opportunity to engage? So again, I don't think anybody involved in the project is naive in terms of thinking that it's just a panacea, that you know, you throw the laptops over the wall and everything magically happens. And And yet, we really see it as an agency. It's a catalyst for change. And there's a famous paper by Kubin and Tyack about school reform and how school reform is impossible, essentially. And my thesis on school reform is that school reform is impossible if you try to do it from the top down. And the way in which school will change is because there's going to be a generation of children who come to school with such different skills and expectations about school, they'll change school. And the connected laptop is part of how these children and their communities will manufacture that cure, will manufacture that change. So now let me get to sort of the title of the talk, which is Confessions of a Fundamentalist. And I've been accused of being a free and open source fundamentalist, and that I, because of my passion about open source software, I distorted One Laptop Per Child in a way that was detrimental to its mission. And you know, the step one, as we learn in AA to recovery, is to, you know, admit your addiction. I am a fundamentalist. I've said it. I feel better already. But the question is, I'm a fundamentalist about what? Okay, and while I'm passionate about free and open source software, and I'm passionate about its role in learning, what I'm a fundamentalist about is learning itself. And I have very fundamental beliefs about what are the best ways to position learning, what are the best ways to plant the seeds of learning, what are the best ways to engage children in learning, and that's really where my fundamentalism comes to play. So it's I'm happy to leverage open source, and I'll talk about different ways in which we're doing that with the project, but I'm willing to bend my principles there. I'm unwilling to bend my principles about learning. And so, anyway, I've said it. I should talk a little bit about this theory of learning called constructionism. Constructionism is a theory that Seymour Papert developed over the course, again, of over 40 years. Seymour was a student of Piaget's in Geneva back in the late 50s, early 60s, and he got it into his head that maybe there was a role for computation as a thing to think with, and that computation would be something that children should engage in. So he used to fly from Geneva to London to get computer time and get kids in front of the machine. He then came to Cambridge. He used to do some consulting for Bolt, Boranek, and Newman over here, this end of Cambridge. There he and Cynthia Solomon and a few others developed the Logo programming language, which was the first language designed for children. And then he went and joined Marvin Minsky at MIT. They co-founded the Artificial Intelligence Lab there. And then they both jumped ship to the Media Lab in 1985 when we started that effort. But the the essence of what Seymour was about is that it really had to do with not just access to knowledge, but the appropriation of knowledge. And that appropriation, I'll gist it in a way that's not really fair to Seymour, but I'll say you learn through doing. And if you want more learning, you want more doing. And what's a better tool for doing than a computer? Now, that there's a corollary to all this that's also really important, and it's often overlooked in discussions about constructionism, and that is that love is a better master than duty. And so you want to engage people in things they're passionate about. And again, the fact that computation is such a computer, on the one hand, it's a Turing machine, but that means that it can do anything. I learned that in Natural Science 110, long, long ago.
Was I teaching?
Cheatham was still teaching.
AM
110. I'm sorry, AM 110, yeah. But the... you know, the idea that you want to engage people in doing around things that are authentic to them is key. And again, the computer's not necessary for that, but boy, it's a damn good vehicle for engaging people and having what they work on matter. So what they work on really be meaningful to them and meaningful to their community. And there are lots of examples, again, of that meaning really articulating itself. We were involved for many years, still involved in a project in rural Thailand where the children used computation to build maps, and they used the maps to figure out where to build the reservoir for their town, for their village. And by building the reservoir for their village, which the government came in three times previous to that and built the reservoir in the wrong place and it failed, the kids with their map that they built using computation built the reservoir in the right place and revolutionized this village's economy. They have water. And now they actually have, I was visiting about 6 months ago, and they've started a water treatment plant as well in the village. And the next thing they're going to do with their computation is they're going to do the testing of the water themselves. Right now they send the water samples down the mountain path to the town where the university students test it. They're going to take that on themselves. So they're solving problems using computation that are authentic to them, that have real impact in their community, and they're learning. So, you know, there's this false dichotomy that is articulated in this space, and it's been the subject of a lot of the media coverage of one laptop per child. But it's absolutely a false dichotomy, and it's the dichotomy between a teacher-centric and a child-centric view of learning and education. You know, the first of all, Antonio Batro, who's a brain scientist, brought to my attention that one of the things that makes us human is that we're all both learners and teachers. Everyone's a learner, everyone's a teacher. It's just inherent in our being. Also, everyone by their nature, if you're human, you're expressive and you're social. And so those three attributes, you know, learning, teaching, expression, and being social, really are at the heart of learning, whether it's learning with a teacher in front of a class or whether it's learning in some peer-to-peer, child-centric way. So really, you know, the key is not teacher-centric, child-centric. The key is to, as Elliot Soloway from Michigan says, be learning-centric. You really, every decision you make in terms of how you design tools should be, how does this impact the learning? Not how does this impact the teacher or the child, how does this impact the learning? So the other false dichotomy that's sort of been rampant through all this, and particularly over the last couple of months, is the debate regarding proprietary versus free and open source tools. Proprietary tools are often associated with the delivery of knowledge. And in fact, the image that comes to mind is an image that was painted for me by Televisa recently. Televisa is the largest, it's a Mexican company, the largest producer of soap operas in the world. And they have a foundation. The foundation does a lot of work in education. They've been building computer labs in schools for about a decade now. But they're always interested in, are there things we can do that are better? And so one of the things they looked at was these one-to-one computing programs, one laptop per child. And they did it by using the Intel Classmate and Microsoft XP, Windows XP. And they filled four schools with these machines, and nothing changed. And so, boy, they said, you know, this is a waste of time and effort and money. And, you know, so you have to ask yourself, why did nothing change? And what can we do to actually have impact when we make these kinds of investments? What's usually associated with open source is that we're trying to turn every kid into a Linux kernel hacker. Yeah, we are. But we don't expect that every child will actually do that. Really, what we're trying to do is we're trying to just, you know, move the, you know, with any group, you get a standard deviation, and we're just sort of trying to move it over a little bit more towards kids being more likely to be people who appropriate knowledge as opposed to just access knowledge. So really, you know, to me, a lot of the synergy around open source is open source has a culture around appropriation, which I think is important to the culture of learning. So that's really, to me, the biggest, it's this cultural value that's the most important thing. So, you know, if you, and again, it's not fair, you can do service-oriented learning with open source tools, and you can do constructionist learning with proprietary tools. But it's not clear to me that the service-oriented stuff is really actually very good. Yeah, sure. Well, so let me give an example. You know, another company that we'd been working with, and I've been working with for over a decade, is Televisa, phone company. Telmex. Televisa is the TV company. Telmex, you know, is interested in delivering knowledge through phones. Telephone industry is about service, and a simple question I like to ask. I'll ask this audience, why not? I see how many positive responses I get. When was the last time any of you wrote a program for your phone? Anybody write programs? Oh, Ben has written, yeah. Okay. And when you wrote that program for your phone, Mako, did you write it on your phone? Okay. How many of you have ever written an essay on your phone? You text message on your phone all the time, but...
SSH login to something.
kind of painful, but I mean, just the whole idea that phones are about service; they're not about construction. They're not about and so this there's a sort of a service model around you know, sort of this proprietary infrastructure that I think is not in the service of learning.
It's up to you.
It's fine with me. I don't mind. So.
So you brought up an earlier example in which you said that four fundamental values associated with learning were the fact that all humans learn and teach,
yeah,
as well as the fact that humans are social, and there was a fourth one that's escaped me at the moment.
Expressive,
thank you. And you've shown one way in which phones fail to cater to our expressivity,
yeah.
But it does seem to me that they cater very strongly.
Yeah, that's is that a question or is that a comment?
Well, the question here was what impact this observation has on your dichotomy of service-oriented learning versus.
Okay, I think that the social nature of phones is very powerful and very useful, and I'm not anti-phone at all. I even have a phone, but is that the optimal solution for learning? I will argue no, because it is lacking in terms of these other attributes. And so when Mr. Gates says let them eat cell phones as his solution to global learning, I think he's wrong. And I'll saying something that I'll regret later, when OLPC designs their Generation 2 laptop without a keyboard and you know, more and more in the form factor of a book or a cell phone, they're forgetting about the Dyna in DynaBook. And so I think that there's a trajectory there that is a fine trajectory for certain problems, but not the right trajectory for learning. Alan Kay came up with this concept at Xerox PARC in the mid-70s called the DynaBook. And in some sense, the OLPC laptop, and Alan played a big role in the design of the laptop, was an articulation of that vision. But it's not just a book. It's also, in fact, let me use this as an example, because it's an example of, again, where the learning comes to play and where the representation comes to play. I can give you a book, and I can give you that book as a PDF, and you can read it. And I can give you that book as a wiki, and you can read it. And from the point of view of reading that book, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference, except the odds that you're going to go and decompose that PDF file in order to insert a comment are next to nil. The odds that you're going to add a comment to a wiki page are pretty high, given the evidence out there. Now, that doesn't mean that you're being prescriptive, that you're forcing people to add comments. But you're building a platform in which you're skewing the odds towards that kind of activity happening. And so, you know, it's an example of where the representation really does matter and where the culture that you build around that representation really does matter. And it's sort of for things like that where I think that I start to cross a boundary in terms of where my fundamentalism comes into play. You want to build in affordances that, you know, amplify the kinds of behavior you want to see. And the kinds of behavior I want to see are not just access to knowledge, but putting that knowledge to use, engaging in a critical dialogue with other people. And yeah, you can have that dialogue with a phone. But you've got to... Back when I used to run the Media Lab, I had a very simple... You know, it's great to be surrounded by, you know all these self... proclaim smartest people on the planet. So you don't have to worry about being smart, but what you have to worry about is process and making sure that they engage in a process that's going to lead to something useful. And so I used to have a very simple process, which is three steps. Three is the right number for these things. I learned that from Nicholas. Step one is imagine and realize. Okay, so ideas are cheap, but you got to realize your ideas. You got to build it, because once you build it, you can advance to step two. And step two is critique and reflect. See, because until you build it, you can't kick the tires, you can't engage in that critical dialogue. So you know the phone isn't very good for maybe it's fine for the imagine, but even there, I think it's lacking. But it certainly isn't good for the realize, and maybe it's good again for the critique part, maybe. And then step three is very simple, iterate. Go back to step one, because, you know, you're at university, and if you're done after step two, you haven't challenged yourself particularly. You use your time at university to make really big mistakes, because you won't have that opportunity anywhere else in life. So, you know, shoot high and you know, fall hard and get up and go at it again. So... You know, again, it's all about making sure that the tool has the right affordances. So let me talk a little bit about free as in speech, because there's a culture around learning that I think wants to be free. Learning wants to be free. And, you know, again, there's this wonderful culture around open source. We were having a conversation earlier about governance. And how do you, and I'm struggling with this right now with the Sugar Labs project, what is going to be the governance model? How do you decide? And there are all these different things that have to get decided all the time. But there's a difference between governance and the engagement of the community in a critical discourse. They're not coincident, those two vectors. You know, they're not orthogonal, but they're not coincident. And so the open source community has developed over the last 15 years or so a number of very powerful tools around engaging in collaboration and engaging in critique. And I think that those tools, for the most part, are lacking in the world of education. Now, maybe they're not lacking in university education. They certainly are lacking in primary education. And so how do we embody some of that and transform, you know, take that gene and implant it into the world of education? How do we get people to really engage in critical dialogue about things, to make things, to critique them, to compare and contrast, to show me the code? If you want it, you think it should be this, then show me, and then we can engage in a discussion about it. So it's that kind of culture that I think is unleashed in open source that I think is a really, again, a very powerful culture for learning. Let me give an example of where that's been applied. I'll go to Nigeria. And this is we started a pilot in Nigeria over a year ago, and it was with a fairly primitive version of both the hardware and the software. But in Nigeria, depending on which metric you use, there are anywhere between 300 and 500 languages. It depends on where you draw the line. The official language of Nigeria is English, but the official language of Nigeria, English, is, at best the second or third language for most Nigerians. So we were in a school in Abuja, and in that school, the first language of most of the kids in the school was Igbo. And the kids, the official language in school is English, so the laptop, the laptop was set to be English by default. And the kids were a little bit frustrated because they were using the Abbey word, the word processor, but they were writing in Igbo. And they realized there's no spelling dictionary in Igbo in the word processor. It was an English spelling dictionary. And so what did they do? They wrote their own spelling dictionary for Igbo. So two things happened. One is they solved this immediate problem they had. They built a spelling dictionary for Igbo. But the other thing that happened was that they discovered in themselves that they can do this, that they can actually, they don't have to wait for Microsoft. Microsoft, incidentally, has just recently finally released Office in Igbo, Hausa, and Yoruba. That happened just several months ago now. Now, this is one of the wealthiest, most populous countries in all of Africa, and Microsoft's only just gotten around to releasing their products in the three major languages of that country. So sending a message to these kids or having them discover the message themselves, that they actually can do this themselves, that they can appropriate not just the knowledge but appropriate the tool and create something of value to themselves or their community, and in fact, they could share that Igbo dictionary with all the other Igbo speakers, and they could share that methodology with the kids in rural Peru who don't speak Spanish as their first language. So there's a real power there, and to me, that's a game changer. So I want to talk a little bit about something called sugar. And, excuse me. Because sugar is the user experience that, until recently, comes by default with the OLPC laptop. It's also something that's being bundled into a lot of other distributions and other platforms now. So if you're interested in exploring sugar, you could do things like load Hardy Heron, the new Ubuntu release, and do an apt-get sugar, and you can choose sugar as your session manager on a conventional laptop. You don't need an OLPC laptop to do it. But sugar really is something that we designed to try to tease out some of these attributes around learning that we think are so important. So sugar, went back to first principles, those be expressive, be social, be a learner, and be a teacher, and really was based on those first principles. But also sugar didn't try to reinvent everything. Sugar tried to steal as many good ideas as it could from elsewhere. So for example, we already have a lot of fabulous ways of being expressive, being social on the internet. Now, their websites like, well, yeah, we could say Facebook is a social site, and a site where people are expressive, for example. There are many. People use the internet to chat. They use their phones to chat. So there are a lot of ways in which people collaborate already. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to make a lot of those things be first-order experiences in the interface as opposed to things you go over there to do. So we just drew a lot of examples, and really sort of at the core of Sugar is this notion of activity. So we put a wrapper around, most people think about computer applications. You run an application like the word processor, like the calculator. We sort of put a wrapper around the notion of application and turned it into something called an activity. An activity is an enhancement of an application in three ways. One of them is that it brings this notion of sharing, of being social, right there. It's not, again, something you go elsewhere to do. It's something that's always present. The presence of others is always with you. And so, for example, I could go to, it used to be called Writely, and now it's Google Docs, but I could go and use Google Docs to do to create a document, and I could invite somebody to edit that document, do peer editing with that document. But in Sugar, in the word processor, that's just one mouse click away all the time, whether I'm connected to the internet or not. The idea that somebody else can put their cursor in my document and work with me on it. So the idea of if I'm reading something and I want to share it with another person, it's one mouse click away. And now it's out there to be shared. So the idea of making sharing, collaboration, making presence be something that is a first order function is part of what you get by sort of being part of the Sugar process. Second thing you get in Sugar is something called the journal. And what the journal is, at one level, what the journal is it's just a file system that automatically saves everything you do. So you never have to hit save in Sugar. You never have to back up your work. In fact, I'm reminded Alan Kay told me years ago about they used to have two word processors at Park back in the 70s. One word processor had every feature you could imagine, some that even OpenOffice hasn't rediscovered yet. The other word processor guaranteed that you never lost more than two keystrokes, no matter what happened. Somebody could shoot a bullet through the machine, and you'd only lose two keystrokes. Guess which word processor everybody used? So part of what Sugar does with the journal is just make sure that everything's always saved, everything's always preserved. But really, the importance of the journal is that it's creating a diary for you. It's actually creating a portfolio of your work. And so it's this place where you can go back and watch your progress. It's a place where you can have a conversation with your teacher, with your parent about your project progress. So it's really about the importance of progress, of time, of this march through time. That turns out to be an important feature of learning. And so we try to capture that directly in the system. And the third thing about Sugar is really sort of an emphasis on a simplified, transparent framework. But that simplified framework means that there's a very low floor, it's a very low barrier to get into Sugar, but the transparency means that there's essentially there's no ceiling. And let me just give a very simple example from music with Sugar. We have a system called TamTam that was put together by Jean Pichet and his students up at the University of Montreal. And it's a progression. The first part of TamTam is just called Mini TamTam, and it's like a busy box. The computer just turns into a choice of about 100 musical instruments. You choose one, you hit the keyboard, and you're making noise. And literally, two-year-olds take to it instantly. And also, I know a really talented musician in Brazil who was able to make beautiful music with it. But you can imagine outgrowing it. There's actually a library of about 3,000 more instruments on the web that you can use to download into TAM-TAM if you choose to. But some children progress from TAM-TAM to something called TAM-TAM-JAM. TAM-TAM-JAM is more network-centric, so you can jam with other laptops. You also can layer rhythms and multiple instruments on top of each other. But then some kids progress from there to TAM-TAM-EDIT. TAM-TAM-EDIT's a sequencer. You use it to compose music and lay down the layers. Then from TAM-TAM-EDIT, you can progress to the synthesizer lab and design your own instrument. And you can play around with waveforms and random number generators and the like. And this instrument you design in TAM-TAM, in the synth lab, you can drop down into the busy box, or you can share it with other people. And then you can hit function space, and there's a little gear on the space key, and that's a that's called the view source key. And that takes you into Chris's Python editor called Pippy, and you can actually edit the Python code that's underlying these programs. Or you can drop into a C sound editor, which is a scripting language for music, and start hacking C sound, which is the... again, sort of C sound is sort of MIDI on steroids. It's what the pros use to actually really control music for musical special effects and the like. So Sugar starts simple, and it gives you, a tool a two-year-old can use, and it takes you through this progression. Should you choose to climb that hill, to the same tools the pros use, and so this notion of no upper bound on complexity. Is central to Sugar, and again it articulates itself through the choice of the primary choice of Python as the language that underlies Sugar and underlies application and activity development in the laptop. Python by its nature is open and transparent. It's all there, and so while you might not want to do, really heavy lifting on the laptop, at least not one laptop, because you don't have enough short-term memory to work on a really small screen. It's one of the reasons why cell phones never will replace computers. It's why Mako didn't write his program on his phone. But the nice thing about Sugar is that these laptops come in bunches. So you could actually take advantage of this wonderful thing that the Andrew Windows system did even before the X Windows system did, which is let you, pop Windows up on multiple displays and multiple screens and actually spread out and really make a powerful work environment. So the idea that multiple kids together are going to engage in debugging together to figure these things out is part of what's unleashed in Sugar. So anyway, again, Sugar is leaving the I'll use the word narrow, not pejoratively, but it's leaving the narrow confines of one laptop per child and reaching out to be a general purpose environment in the Linux and perhaps even in the Windows world. It's not clear to me how to do it in the Windows world, and I don't have the resources to do it in the Windows world, but nonetheless, that might happen as well. So there's a new... I guess I'll call Sugar Labs the Sugar Upstream, and OLPC is Sugar Downstream, and there'll be a number of Sugar Downstreams over time. Still most of the Sugar development is happening at OLPC, and I don't see that changing for a while. There are a lot of dedicated people making great things happen there, but there's a growing community around the project, and that community is doing more and more interesting things, as evidenced by Ben sitting in the back of the room. I should say, let me just tell you about one of Ben's projects, and it is imaginative, and it actually really captured the spirit of what we were trying to do in ways we never envisioned, which is again one of the powers of open source is that you don't have to have all the ideas. And in fact, there as smart as we are in this room, there's even more intelligence out there somewhere. So leveraging that is only efficient, but so Ben built a little system called Distance, and it measures the distance between two laptops using sound. So the first laptop makes a little crackly whistle. The second laptop hears it, echoes back, and then measuring the time propagation between them. As long as you've got your you know, humidity and altitude parameters set properly, you can measure distance between two laptops, and it's a lot of fun. So the kids go around and measure each other's height and things like that. Now, what Ben never did, what I've wanted him to do, and for some reason he refuses to do, and maybe I'll do myself, is I want to be able to change the units inside of sugar on the fly, inside of distance on the fly. I want to be able to measure the Harvard Bridge across the Charles River, not in meters or in smoots, but in benders. So I should be able to do that with my laptop. So just the idea that we can introduce the concept to the kids that distance metrics are relative, and they can invent their own. I still think you should do that, Ben. Anyway, so sugar itself, actually, at this point in my talk, I was going to quote the French mathematician Pascal. I won't quote him in French. I'll give the shorter version in English, which is, if I had more time, I'd write you a shorter letter. And I guess to some degree, if I'd had more time to prepare for this talk, I would have made it shorter as well. Sugar itself is pretty raw. It's pretty new. It's alpha software. It's buggy. It's flaky. It's in the hands of about 600,000 kids, which is pretty good. But it's getting better all the time, and it's getting seriously better all the time. And we're going to get the Harvard CS department to work on it as well. But you know, it's got challenges, but nonetheless, those challenges are being met. And the early adopters, you know, there are a lot of pretty brave kids in Peru and Uruguay and the like. But they're giving us feedback. They're making improvements. And while we stumble and make mistakes, nonetheless, this is going to it's going to work. So now I come to David Hilbert, and I'd promised Harry. I'm stealing a page from David Hilbert's playbook. Hilbert, as probably most of you recall, in 1900, he was a German mathematician. Came up with he posed 23 problems to the world of mathematics. And those 23 problems actually define much of the next 100 years of mathematics. Some of those problems were ill-formed. Some of those problems were actually ended up not being all that hard for at least really smart people. But most of them were just right. And really, you know, as we were discussing earlier, you know, he had a pretty high percentage of hits there. Now, I'm no David Hilbert. And I don't have any problems nearly as difficult as the Riemann hypothesis. But nonetheless, what I did, and maybe rather than reading these all out, all 23, I'll just blog them. But I've got 23 problems that I think are facing people who are interested in technology and learning. And some of those problems are problems of computer science, mundane things like, how can we make the damn network work? Because the network doesn't work. There's issues around file systems. There's issues around making code that is malleable but doesn't turn into malware. So we want kids to be able to hack code, but at the same time, we want to give them some protection against doing damage to themselves and each other. So there's an issue about, I mean, we need at least two orders of magnitude better tools for localization and internationalization. We're just scratching the surface there, and that's going to explode. That's about to explode. Anyway, there are a whole bunch of questions there. There are a bunch of engineering questions. Maybe the most interesting one has to do with power. Just how do we do a better job of using more wisely a very scarce resource and getting scarcer all the time, particularly when you live off the grid. How do you, and if you're turning a crank using calories to generate power for your computer, you better not waste any. And that's actually one of the problems that Chris focuses on. Education, in my mind, probably the one of the big questions has to do with the validation of constructionism at scale. We know it works in small, but can we prove that it works in scale? Because unless we do, we're going to have a hard time, you know, getting, you know, the top-down stuff happening. We're going to get, you know, the extent to which we can really articulate this clearly, it'll be a little bit easier to make inroads with, you know, ministers of education and the like, and they're still roadblocks. You know, it's funny, you can talk to, you know, the head of state, and they get it, and you can talk to any teacher, parent, or kid, and they get it, but that education bureaucracy in the middle is like any other large bureaucracy. Its goal is to perpetuate today, and so we need better tools for, you know, introducing change. We need to, you know, listen to Cuban and Tayac and figure out ways around their arguments. There are a lot, again, this issue around transplanting the culture of freedom and critique from computer science into the School of Education is another challenge. Then there are lots of challenges around economics. I mean, we were talking about one around governance earlier. I think that, you know, there hasn't been enough good work even correlating learning with economic development and really being able, you know, I can go and talk to the Minister of Finance in Egypt and he gets it, but the Minister of Education doesn't. And so, you know, there's work to be done just there. You know, is it hypothesis or is it fact that learning does lead to economic development? Yeah. We're running out of time.
Well, you want to get a conversation going.
Yeah, that's okay.
The time's yours. You use it
okay.
as you want.
Anyway, So I'll blog these or post them somewhere so you can see all 23. It took Hilbert a while. He didn't sort of have all 23 all well-defined and refined, you know, at the beginning. So mine are a little sloppy as well. They'll get better over time. But I'll try to keep to 23 because that seems to be the
okay.
It's prime.
The floor is open for conversation.
You punned earlier that learning should be free, and what free has meant has been a source of great grief in the free and open source software community. Could you comment a little bit on which senses of the word you've intended?
Not free as in beer. You know, I think that it really comes down to having both the actuality and the culture that, you know, knowledge is to be appropriated. Again, for those of you in computer science, I don't know anybody, and maybe there's a counterexample in the room, I don't know anybody who ever learned a program by not copying code. That's how you learn to program. You copy it, you break it, you fix it, you make it do something you want. That kind of freedom, I think, is a culture that exists it's part of the engineering culture, but it's not a general culture in learning. So that's the part that needs to be transplanted. Yeah. Yeah, there were five announced just last week.
Right. Okay. My question is, do you think that ultimately this will halt the cause of, you know, of learning, you know, using computers by making, you know, this inexpensive hardware more readily available, or do you think it will hurt it by making people lose sight of the mission of learning?
Oh, I think it'll absolutely help because, you know, getting inexpensive hardware out there is a necessary condition because, you know, in Maine, we helped start a laptop project up in Maine about 5 years ago, and they're using these Apple laptops, and I forget how much they cost, but let's pretend they cost $1,000. And let's be generous and say that they will last 5 years. So that's amortized over the 5 years, that's a $200 a year investment by the state of Maine, which sounds like a lot of money until you consider they're spending close to $10,000 a year per child on education. and all of a sudden the $200 doesn't seem like a whole lot. You go to Guatemala, and they spend maybe $200 per child per year on education. So you can't even get the conversation started if you're talking about a $1,000 laptop. It just doesn't make any sense. So, you know, the fact that, and I'll assert it as a fact, that OLPC has put pressure on the industry to make inexpensive hardware is a real good thing. A real good thing, because it makes these things accessible. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about cultural assumptions, constructivism, etc.? It seems to be a model of how we learn. Is the assumption that this is cross-cultural, related to humans, and if not, what are the considerations for this hardware that has the
No, there are a lot of things that are culture bound in terms of learning, and in fact, one of the questions in my list of 23 has to do with trying to understand the impact of constructionism on culture, as opposed to the other way around. But constructionism itself is built on first principles that are not, I think, culturally dependent. They're based on constructionism's about people, unequivocally. But it's about how people learn. It's no more culturally tied than Piaget. I mean, it was based on Piaget's constructivism concepts, and it's got to do with how does the mind develop. Now again, if you think about love is a better master than duty. What people are going to love, what's important to children is going to vary, culture to culture. But the concept of constructionism is universal. Yeah, but. But part of it is, again, you want to do that, but you also want to engage in a discussion with other people about what you're discovering. Have them beat up on you. And that's actually one of the things that people harp on is, what's the role of the teacher? And in fact, the role of the teacher becomes unleashed. The teacher becomes a mentor. The teacher's actually having a lot more fun. And another thing that happened in Abuja is that in Abuja it took 2 weeks, and in Islamabad it only took 1 week for the teacher to throw the stick out the window. They still had corporal punishment, and the teacher realized he didn't need the stick anymore. Yeah.
But your example in Nigeria is very interesting to me, in that this constructivist notion is also challenges the concept of authority, and that which part is somewhat cultural. But the fact that someone can go and build something on their own, that they can discover it on their own, or localism, and when you sort of, the implications that are quite dramatic, institutionally and everywhere, right?
Yeah.
So, and you may get some resistance on that basis as well, because that unleashes a sense of empowerment, which is not necessarily always local.
Yeah. That's why the finance minister is always interested, because the finance minister immediately connects the dots and says, that's how I'm going to get entrepreneurs, that's how I'm going to get the economy. But then it's not clear that the education minister follows suit. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, if they haven't gotten there first, they're shortly after. I think that this is going to be one of the big, battles, big social battles, and economic battles over the next, 20, 30 years, and some people are going to do it, some people aren't going to do it, and the people that go with open source, I believe, are going to do better in the long run, but that,
But But that is a piece of the fundamentalism.
Yeah.
And the interesting question to me is not how many cheap laptops are going to exist in a week, but how many are going to exist in 5 years. Because the evolution of this, of the industry, we go through these sort of Cambrian explosions,
yeah.
and then you wait 5 years and there's one or two choices is all that's left.
Well, but so there are two points to that. Okay, one point is, I think and I'm projecting here because I don't speak for them anymore, but I think OLPC is trying to keep the pressure on, so that won't. That the industry won't slip back. But I also think that there seems to be enough of this happening now and an awakening to a big enough market that the industry is going to, there are going to be people, might not be, the Dells and the Lenovos, but it might be somebody else that's in there. There are five companies that announced these things last week. On the other hand, I do worry, okay, I worry about, I worry about the Televisa experience, because if these things are used in the let's replace chalkboards with laptops, then the world's going to figure out very quickly this doesn't add value, and it's actually going to be a drag on the process. So in fact, doing it wrong does have some negative implications in terms of the long term, in terms of how soon the good guys are going to win.
There were lots of hands up. You shouldn't have jumped in there. But you why don't you just call people?
Here, and I'll get to you next, Ben. Yeah.
What about when you move up the scale from children and you look at college students and professional schools? Some of these principles are not necessarily being taught. In my opinion, what's your experience?
I think that part of one's education should be, getting dirt under your fingernails and building stuff. And there's a long tradition of that. That's not a crazy wacko idea. I mean, there used to be this, Aristotle used to talk about stuff like that, and that was sort of the Renaissance model as well. Sort of the factory model of learning and the learning in the abstract is a relatively new concept, and it's certainly got its place, perhaps.
About technology, as it relates to technology, say, in medical school, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, MIT has this wonderful thing called MIT Students, and it also has this wonderful thing invented by Edwin Land called Europe. Which MIT students for work study. When I did work study here, they were rearranging the stacks in the Far East Library, and so I moved books around. And I got a lot of exercise, but I didn't learn a whole lot. I never opened the books. At MIT, when they do work study, they're working in the laboratories, and I think that that's a fabulous program. There are a lot of examples out there, and some people. I don't really have an answer. It's just to say that there are examples out there of doing a good job or not. Anyway, let me get Ben's question. He was being patient in the back.
So I was thinking about the Nigeria trial.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that happened to have some sort of what hardware and software they were running. And they were, in most cases, very early prototypes.
Right.
In fact, early prototypes to the point that we've thrown out a lot of the designs. The processor and battery and basically the entire interface. And I'm curious about sort of your feeling that trial was successful, because in my mind, what was tried out there looked really bad, like awful.
Everything is relative. I think what we have today is much better. But I'll tell you, those kids were learning and constructing back then.
So I guess my specific example is many of the features that you listed about network connectivity, about chat, about sharing, writing documents, were sort of borderline non-functional.
Did the students know that?
Well, they must have figured it out fairly quickly.
It's funny because the document sharing worked a little bit better back then than it does now, for a number of unrelated reasons. But there were certain aspects of scaling that worked better than work now, just because we weren't taxing the system in the same ways. But one of the nice things about the OPC design is, the concept is it's one laptop per child, okay, which means that there's lots of laptops there, okay, but there's also lots of children there, okay, so you don't forget the child part of the one laptop per child. And children have a lot of out-of-band mechanisms for communication as well, and they exploited those out-of-band mechanisms, like talking to each other.
Sure.
And Well, in fact, I think you can achieve success without the fancy features you're working on to some degree. But I think that it's not quite a Hawthorne effect, but it's a little bit like a Hawthorne effect or a placebo effect, in the sense that by going there and saying, "Hey, this is yours," and it's about expression, it's about sharing, about communication, that in and of itself was enough to make the change. Now, once we make the change, we want to have the growth, be able to support the growth. And I think where those early systems failed was being able to support the growth. But I think that they had enough already to introduce the change of culture in the classroom. Well, let me say, kids are sufficiently powerful to paper over defects.
So on the IRC channel, there was some discussion about what it is that drives people to participate in online discussions, online projects, and maybe even on discussions and projects in real space as well. And whether this is a function of the person, or the project, or the community, or the tools. And is there a chance that you could elaborate on what assumptions sugar is making about what actually drives the balance and what we can do to...
Sugar is actually a real anomaly in this respect, and it's quite interesting to me. It's something that maybe somebody should try to understand more deeply. Most open source projects, the people who participate are the people who use it. Okay, so you hack on code that you use because you want that code to be better. Okay, up until recently, sugar was not something anybody was ever going to use. I mean, it was something kids are using out there, but the sugar community of hackers was not the community of users. So it was actually an anomalous case in the world of open source projects. But I think that what happened, and I'll very much give Nicholas Negroponte credit for this, that he really captured the world's imagination that this was important, and these people, came to the table and continue to come to the table because they believe that this is important.
Striking to me that five people were working on it, but I would say the person working on it in the paper then what seems like a good idea. And when these people show up, and they're renting companies and they're motivated, and really as people, and they offer their help. I can't explain it with the general levels of scratching their addictions.
I can speak to that a little bit, because it's an observation I've also made. But what struck me most intensely about it, as I analyze where have all the sugar developers gone in the last few months, and why have the few that have stuck around in fact stayed, what's most apparent to me is that the people who have stayed are often people who you or I or various other people are personally friends with, who are attracted by some of the glory or valor of the idea itself that I'm going to have hundreds of thousands of kids use changes that I make here. Now, that's important to me. You shake your head, Walter.
I don't know. Maybe that's what's driving some people. I don't think most people are in it for the glory. I think people are in it because they see this as a way to make a difference. And
we have one more question.
Yeah, I guess we have to wrap up. Yeah, okay. Well, there certainly has been a tension on the project from the design perspective, and we hired this company Pentagram to work with us on the design. And Pentagram is, they're real designers. They're pros. They, the laptop design, the sugar interface ended up in the Museum of Modern Art permanent collection. It's like super design. On the one hand, on the other hand, I agree with you that that's maybe a little bit, I'm going to go and mess with the Pentagram design. Maybe I better not, because but we thought about it in a slightly different way. And actually, one of the neat things is, like with everything, people have already done skins, so you can replace the old PC icon set with, a different skin, and some of those are a little bit more inviting, perhaps, but. The other issue is one that we wrestled with, and Michael wrestles with it, and Chris as well, in terms of their own work on the project, and that is, how do you make an environment where, rather than making things, you don't want things to break, okay, but on the other hand, you want people to explore, and so how do you find that balance? So the way we chose to approach it was to say, rather than try to harden everything and make it hard to break, we'll make it easy to repair. So as long as it's easy to get back to where you were, we're hoping that means that people will be more willing to try things and take risks and make mistakes. So it was more along the line, you'll never lose stuff, as opposed to, so I think that some of it has to do with that approach. But I don't think we know the answer to your question.
Thank you. I hope we'll be seeing more of you over the coming year.
Cool. Well, thank you, and thanks for giving me a chance to pinch hit. And I need some time with you afterwards, Mako.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Good questions. And
thank you.
Good. We finished with six.